You're listening to Can Science Disprove God? By Jeremy Livermore. Jeremy is a staff apologist at apologetics.com in the United States. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference on March 9th, 2013 at Northview Community Church.
Okay, well, for those of us who have heard of science, I don't really need to explain it too much. This is not PowerPoint. This is kind of an outline that went really... the formatting really sucks on this outline. I'm so sorry. I teach a class, Scientific Apologetics, in L.A., and I use a 300-page outline that I've developed over the last year or so. So this is kind of just a snapshot of some things that we talk about in our science class, Scientific Apologetics class. And so this isn't the 300-page outline, but this is just kind of stuff I've thrown together. In the throwing together of this outline, the formatting became wacky. So I apologize for that in advance. And I didn't have time to make a PowerPoint, so I kind of just turned the screen blue, and it is kind of a PowerPoint, yeah? So just trying to impress you. But there's a picture of science. And okay, so... just to get going here, oftentimes we hear questions like these. Doesn't science deal only with nature? Why are you bringing up science when we are talking about Christianity? Or we hear questions like, aren't science and Christianity incompatible realms? What if we were to ask questions back? Is it possible that Christianity is actually compatible with science? Or to raise the bet a little bit, is it possible that science actually proves God exists? Can actually prove God exists? Well, it all depends on what we mean by prove. Deductive proof? No, there's no mathematical formula that proves God. But again, there's no mathematical formula that disproves God. And this is because science uses inductive and abductive reasoning. Now, inductive reasoning is just getting a bunch of evidence and seeing where it leads. And this is used in court cases often as well, and in science. But abductive reasoning is also like that too. You get a bunch of pieces of evidence, and you generate a big body of evidence, and you generate hypotheses that best explains the evidence. What hypotheses explains this chunk of evidence over here? Then you choose which hypotheses best explains it. So this is known as making an inference to the best explanation. And this is what Darwin did when he came up with his idea. He had a bunch of pieces of evidence, and he said, what best explains all this stuff? And that's how he got his Origin of Species. And theory of evolution. So what we're saying then is, can science prove or disprove God? The actual question to be asked instead of that question is by the Christian and non-Christian is, does science support the Christian worldview, or does science contradict the Christian worldview, since we can't deductively prove God exists? So we can only create a case. We can create an argument, an inductive argument, or use abductive reasoning to determine whether or not something supports this idea, or this body of evidence supports this hypothesis. So can we soundly show in this session together today that science supports Christianity by building an argument with premises supported by recent scientific observations? And the answer I'm saying is yes. And so why are we talking about this? Well, first of all, because we need to respond to harsh criticisms that are out there in the public square. You may have heard Richard Dawkins or Daniel Dennett or Christopher Hitchens or others known as the New Atheists present harsh criticisms against Christianity in the public square. Are any of you familiar with those guys? Okay, well, then there's this other guy who's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist who comes out of nowhere and says crazy stuff like, science sets people free from their religious superstition. So these new atheists are just a few of the many who like to bash Christianity publicly. And they do so from a scientific basis. And that's why they get attention, because they're scientists and they're important people. Well, the Christian has to make a response to this comment, and that response needs to be put forward in the public square. And the other reason why we're talking about this is because it matters to non-Christians, because non-Christians hold science in high regard. 55% of the public sees science conflicting with religion. That's a lot of the public. 55% will have an intellectual barrier to coming to faith in Jesus due to the idea that they have that science conflicts with religion. And that's a lot of people. And so reaching out, reaching the non-Christians by removing intellectual barriers and doubts caused from science is what we're about here. And if you think about apologetics in general, if you're kind of new to apologetics, it's kind of this idea that we're tearing down the walls of that people build up, whether they knowingly build them up or not, whether it's just the psychological thing that's happening in the back of their head because of childhood trauma and stuff like that. People have walls that they put up, and that prevent them from coming to see Jesus face to face. And apologetics is the idea that we're bringing down the walls, we're tearing down those walls as best we can in any way, shape, or form to allow people to see Jesus face to face and make a decision. And that's kind of the background of apologetics. And so that's what we're doing with scientific apologetics. And so we need to do this. And so academic non-Christians, is anyone familiar with Antony Flew? Okay, yeah, some of us. Well, you may have heard the story about how this renowned atheist philosopher, who became known as one of the world's leading philosophers along with Bertrand Russell and others from like 1950 to say 2000, he was considered and highly regarded by atheists. They championed him as, you know, their leader, kind of like we look to other awesome Christian philosophers today. And so he's kind of like the Richard Dawkins of 1950 to 2000, you know, in terms of outspoken critics against Christianity. And what made his position finally untenable was scientific evidence. It wasn't philosophy. Not to say that I love philosophy. I do philosophy all the time. I teach philosophical apologetics. But it was science that actually convinced this guy, and he came out with this book, There Is a God. Cross out, no. He actually became a deist or a theist because of scientific evidence. This is just earth-shattering, and no one really talks about it. But this guy, I heard him debate live Gary Habermas at my college when I was in school. And there are crowds, you know, flocked to the auditorium. It was packed out, overflow rooms and everything. And the point is that science matters. The results of science can convince one of the world's leading atheists, like Antony Flew, to believe in the existence of God. Now, this is a big deal. The other reason why we're talking about it is because Christians need it. Christians have intellectual conflicts, uncertainty, and doubts too. And can we just say that doubts are okay? If we have doubts, it's okay. We want to embrace our doubts and find answers to them. But we want to become more certain over time about things. It requires some investigation. So don't just let your doubts linger. Go pursue them and work them out. Now, this is interesting. This little chart is a poll that was conducted recently, and it talks about the public's views about life's origins and developments. Now, we're not going to spend a lot of time here because this is all just introductory in nature. But interestingly, a lot of us could identify, could say that we're evangelical Protestant. And so what I'm just going to say about this little chart is that for evangelical Protestants, 55% say that evolution has occurred and 35% say that it, or 55% say it hasn't and 35% say it has occurred. So as a whole, we're not really sure about what's going on with evolution. We're very uncertain. So we need to kind of get our act together and figure it out. Now, also, Christians perceive a conflict. 48% of those who attend religious services once a week see a conflict between science and religion, and this is a lot of us. If you think about your church and you picture how many people are in there, say 300 or whatever, and you say 48% of them perceive there to be a conflict between science and religion, that's a lot of people. That's 150 people. Now, extrapolate that across, you know, all of North America, and you can see that Christians need to figure this out because we obviously don't have our act together when it comes to understanding how our faith relates to science. Interestingly, younger Christians are being affected by this alleged hostility to science. A recent study was conducted and it found that six key factors are contributing to an overall loss of faith of young people. One of the six factors are churches come across as antagonistic to science. So it's affecting our young people too. And many are walking away from the faith for a lot of reasons, but maybe that's a contributing reason. So why are we talking about this now? Is because confusion abounds in the public square. A lot of people don't understand the difference between philosophy of science and science. And many people are confusing philosophy of science with science. What I mean is something like this. Can science prove a creator exists? And the question, does science prove a creator exists? Those are different questions. One is a philosophical, this one, metaphysical question or epistemological, and this is a scientific question. And so if we use science to prove or build a case that science supports the idea of that God exists, then we are showing that science proves a creator exists. So if we can do this, then this is true. It's yes. Now, many people say, no, science can't prove a creator exists, so this question's irrelevant. And that's what happens, is people just stop at this question in the public square. And they never get to even, they don't even entertain the idea that science can prove a creator exists or build a case for a creator. And that's what I'm saying there. And so the other reason why we're looking at this is because recent scientific discoveries are quickly changing our understanding of the universe, ourselves, and God. And in the last 100 years, we've had just a plethora of scientific discoveries come out, more than ever before in the entire history of the human race. We see history of humanity. We see scientific ideas changing our culture. We see scientific discoveries of our world. They have changed our worldviews. So what is interesting about this is how we understand ourselves in light of these scientific discoveries. How do we think of ourselves in terms of where we are in the universe, and what does this mean? So we have this existential crisis that we've been faced with. But what's really interesting is, how do we make sense of God in all of this? How does God fit into all of these theories about reality? Or could we say that God caused all of reality? So where does God fit into all of this? And it turns out that Christianity is not left behind. We have good reasons to be excited about the results of science. And Christianity is well capable of handling anything that science comes up with. So our faith is quite profound in that sense, much more profound than science. Now, the goal here today is to ask ourselves questions and answer them. And we're going to build an argument together that we can use in our own future study and share with our friends on the street. We're going to kind of do a little workshop amongst ourselves and just see kind of how we can create an argument together. And then the idea here is to show that science independently supports the Christian worldview. So kind of the overall outline you can create, this is something, an argument I've created, is premise 1, 2, and 3, 4, you'll see. But the idea here is that premise 1 answers this question, premise 2 answers this question. So the question, doesn't science deal only with nature? Why are you bringing up science when we're talking about Christianity? You hear things like this. And so premise 1 is this. Scientism and naturalism, our worldview is not science, and are rejected due to their irrationality. Now, this is a philosophical statement and a philosophical premise. And how to argue this premise, you have to use philosophy. And in my class, I spend 7 weeks just on this premise alone. So we don't have time to get into that today. So I'm going to skip that, if you don't mind. Because I want to get to the science stuff, because that's what you saw. You saw the word science on your thing, so you came because of that. Now, if you want to go to philosophy, we could talk about that later. So aren't science and Christianity incompatible realms? You hear this question? So premise 2. Now, keep in mind, now if you didn't have these questions, you could still build this argument and present the case yourself. So in your own church or something, or Bible study, you could kind of put these premises together. You could steal mine, that's fine, and use them. So ignore the questions if you want and just look at the premises. Aren't science and Christianity incompatible realms? Well, the answer is no, science and Christianity are not incompatible, but are better understood as compatible sources of knowledge. So here we're moving from philosophical premise to worldview premise, and so then we need to argue for this. So how do we do that? Well, I'll mention a couple things about that. Now, hasn't science disproven God by showing that the universe and all of its contents are entirely a result of natural causes? We hear this a lot. It's kind of like this naturalism idea. Well, premise 3, intelligent design is inferred as the most plausible explanation of recent scientific observations that reveal a stunning universe. Design can be seen in astrophysics, physics, and biology. And today we're going to try to talk about these two things, astrophysics and biology. Now, premise 4 answers this question. Doesn't science contradict the Bible? Premise 4, biblically based Christian views are harmonious with scientific observations. So the idea here, if you put premise 1, 2, 3, 4 together, you can support the conclusion that science independently supports the Christian worldview based on the truth of these four premises. You can build an inductive argument. Now, we're going to try to focus on this, you know, with just a little bit of time we have here. But I do want to make a comment on premise 2. So we're going to skip premise 1 again. So we're kind of going back through the argument now here. And we're now looking at premise 2. So these are kind of the four different views of science and Christianity. You have the conflict view, the independent view, the dialogue view, and the integration view. Now, this is the view I hold. Sometimes this is called the compatibility view, which is why I use the word compatible here. So here, if you break down each of the four views of science and Christianity, each of these four green views, that shows that the compatibility view, or the integration view, is realistic and favorable. So you say, those suck, this one's good. Okay? Do you suck here in Canada? All right. Okay? Now, naturalistic worldview. So like say you have the conflict view, right? Let's look at that one over there on the left just real quick. Well, the conflict view says that, here's how you can draw the differences. Is you can say that the naturalistic worldview says that simple things go to complex things, or the theistic worldview says that complex things go to simple things. The naturalistic worldview, and again, these things are conflicting with each other. This is the conflict view overall. The naturalistic worldview is disorder to order, which is where we're at now. We're human beings living in an ordered world. To disorder, that's what the naturalistic view says. The theistic worldview says that first we had order when God created things, then we're in this state of disorder because of sin and destruction and decay, and then in the future we'll be in an ordered state, you know, back to paradise, if you will, with God. Matter to mind is the naturalistic worldview. You have this matter, a bunch of molecules, they form together in a prebiotic soup, and eventually you get mind, a human with a mind. Mind to matter is the theistic worldview. You start with God's mind and then you create matter from that. Naturalism says that basic life to information, you start with a bunch of chemicals and molecules in the prebiotic soup and they form together because of all these different causes and you get information eventually, the DNA molecule. Whereas the theistic worldview says no, you have information first and then you get basic life later. The cell and all those things come from information. Naturalism, self-create, self-organize, that's the idea, is that universe created everything, nature created everything, matter created everything. Theistic worldview says other created and other organized, God created, God organized. And then you have other things that differentiate the two. So the conflict view says these worldviews are in conflict. Now, what's interesting is that the apparent conflict that most people observe is in the area of worldview difference between the naturalistic worldview and the theist worldview. And it's not between Christianity and science. So that's the confusing thing, is that most people think that or have this conflict view, and they say that Christianity is conflicting with science, but in reality, if they think about it a little bit more, naturalism is what they're saying is conflicting with theism. So science and Christianity are different than naturalism and theism, and we need to understand them as different. Now, these other views of the relationship between science and Christianity, we don't have time to get into, but here's a poll conducted to speak of the compatibility view for a moment, religious belief among scientists. Well, if you say that 33% of scientists believe in God and 18% believe in a higher power, then you have 51% of scientists say that a God or a higher power exists, okay? And that's all I'm trying to show you here, so don't get too excited about that. 51% of current scientists profess belief in God or some sort of being out there. And this 51%, by the way, is not just from that poll conducted a few years ago, but it's consistent with a poll conducted in 1996 and one conducted actually in 1914. So even in the last 100 years of great scientific observations from 1914 till say now, this percentage of scientists is still very consistent of those who believe in some sort of God. Now, that just kind of goes to support this idea that science, especially among scientists, is compatible with their faith. It's compatible. Okay, so I'm not going to get into that too much, but I just want to point that out to you because I thought that was really interesting. And I think the compatibility view is a view that all Christians should hold. Now, to discuss the issues of science and religion, it is important for Christians and non-Christians to understand both directly. That is, if we come across in our investigations some alleged conflict or contradiction in between science and religion, say we're reading Genesis and we can't make sense of why it says this, and then we look at this science journal article and it says something otherwise, then what do we do? Well, we don't just throw out the Bible, throw it in the trash. And we don't just throw out the journal article and throw it in the trash. We have to make sense of both correctly. We have to see, can these things harmonize? And that's not to say we compromise our position. It's just to say we investigate. And that's all I'm suggesting you do is investigate until you get some good answers. And don't throw things out initially like from a knee-jerk reaction. Quantum physics. If you know much about quantum physics, then you would agree that there's a little bit of mystery in quantum physics. There's this whole idea of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And also there's this wave-particle duality, this nature of light. How do we understand light? Is it a wave or is it a particle? And what happens when we go and observe things at the quantum level? Do our observations influence the results of the experiment itself? Whereas most people think of science as that we just do an experiment, we get the results, and we interpret them. But in quantum physics, it turns out that as you observe something, your observation influences the result. So these three things, wave-particle duality influencing results, and the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, those are just a few things in quantum physics that show that there's some mystery there. There's some things that don't quite make sense, aren't intuitive. And although that is true of quantum physics, it's still regarded as one of the big-time fields of science, biology, physics, quantum physics, and such. And it turns out that just as how we developed quantum physics, it's very similar to how the branch of theology known as Christology developed, which has to do with the dual natures of Christ. Is Christ, say, 70% man and 30% human, or 70% human and 30% God, or 100% man and 100% God? How do we understand the dual natures of Christ, philosophically speaking? And it turns out that the early church time, there was a lot of people that were excommunicated out of the church or punished by the church because of their theological beliefs on the dual natures of Christ. And what happened was over 400 years passed or so, and they finally got some parameters together that said, well, if we say this, it's heresy. If we say that, it's heresy. So let's just say something like this. Jesus is 100% man, 100% God. And let's leave it at that because the rest is a mystery and we don't want to say things that are heretical. So again, there's mystery, a little bit of mystery, not things that are contradicting in terms of our theology, but there's mystery there in terms of Christology. And so what I'm just trying to say is that in terms of the compatibility view, is that there are some similarities between how theology has arisen and how certain fields of scientific research has arisen, and one shouldn't be more certain than the other. Or this alleged perceived certainty in one is actually debatable. So, premise three, we talked about this, intelligent design, and then again, we're just kind of moving through it. I gave you a little bit more food for thought there. And this is something you can look at with me here. Doesn't science contradict the Bible? Well, biblically based Christian views are harmonious with scientific observations. That's the fourth premise in building your inductive argument here. Well, what do we mean by biblically based Christian worldviews? Well, in the middle, you have supernatural creation with intelligent design. It's kind of the general idea of how we think about God creating the universe, as opposed to natural creation, steady state, like an infinite or no creation. It's a steady state universe. It's an infinitely old universe. There was no beginning, versus a natural creation, which has various views. Now, if you go to, say, the Christian view, supernatural creation, you have the young earth perspective and the old earth perspective. And from that, you can get to these other more refined theories on how to make sense of, say, Genesis. Now, we're not going to get into all that right now, but I'm just showing you as a fourth premise that there are biblically based Christian views, all of these biblically based Christian views that support the idea that science is harmonious with, the Bible is harmonious with science. And so as you get into these, you can start seeing who is more of the expert in one and the other, and you can start reading their material, and it really, they start to build a case for this premise. Just by a show of hands, if you don't mind, I'm curious to find out how many of us are young earthers or old earthers, and how many of us haven't even thought about this. So who would be a young earther? Okay. And who would be an old earther? Okay. And who hasn't thought about it or doesn't know? What's the undecided? Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. Undecided then? Undecided? Okay. All right. So, no, it's okay. You know, we got to just figure this out. But this is kind of an internal discussion, right? This is amongst Christians of how to figure that out. But interestingly, we can put that together and we could still make this premise and we could present that to the non-believer and say, you know what? We have a bunch of positions that do make sense of science. Our positions are harmonious with science. And when we do that, no matter who's right or who's wrong, we still got something to say that makes this premise true. And it helps in building that inductive case. Okay? Now, I guarantee you one of these positions is right. Which one it is, I don't know. I'm a little undecided, too. I lean towards this RTB model, Reasons to Believe model, and you'll see their booth out there. And I really encourage you to check it out because they've got an amazing amount of resources. This is by far the most developed position of all of the Christian positions. Now, I got to move on, but in conclusion, with those four premises, we get to this this conclusion, and it's supported that science independently supports the Christian worldview, and that conclusion is warranted by the truth of those four premises. Now, back to premise three. In building an inductive case for the existence of God, now you guys came in at for a 1:30 start time, is that right? You came in at 1:15, but we started at 1:30, right? Yeah. Or like we were supposed to start at 1:30? 2:15? Okay. So if we go back to premise three, this is all what you pay the big bucks for, right? Hasn't science disproven God by showing that the universe is, and all of its contents are entirely a result of natural causes? Sometimes non-Christians say this. Well, we say intelligent design is inferred as the most plausible explanation of scientific observations that reveal a stunning universe, and design can be seen in these three areas. Now, if we look at astrophysics, there is a solar system and a DNA molecule that jumped in there because he wanted some camera time. But this is just to say that the universe was gave life an opportunity, gave DNA life an opportunity. So that's kind of what we're getting at here, is that those alive right now, at this moment in human history, are alive at a time when we can finally see the universe transparently. We have now the technology at our disposal to look out there and see what's out there and understand it. And what we've determined is that the initial conditions of the universe were so precise and so perfect that certain features would obtain to allow for life. This is called the fine-tuning of the universe. So who here, if you don't mind, could I ask, has heard of the fine-tuning of the universe? Okay, a lot of us. Did you just get out of that other seminar? Oh, man. Okay, well then this is just going to bore all you people. Because she's great. And I had no idea she was coming and presenting on this, and I know her, actually. We go on the radio together. Anyway, the way to think about fine-tuning, if you bear with me, if you just heard this, is that with a car, you have pistons firing an engine, you have spark plugs, they're doing different things, and they have to be in sequence, right? They have to be in tune with each other. Or your timing belt is off, and you got to go get it fixed, right? Your car doesn't work. You can't get anywhere. Think of a guitar. A guitar, you drop it or you leave it there, it gets out of tune just, you know, quickly. And so you have to tune it. And so that's the idea with fine-tuning, is that the universe is tuned. The actual universe must be tuned for a tuning to the key of life, if you will. Without this tuning, other features would clash and thus create conditions where life is unbearable or impossible. And it seems that if the universe and Earth were finely tuned to a perfect setting, it seems as if the universe and Earth were finely tuned to a perfect setting, and it was tuned to be in perfect resonance and harmony with all the other interacting phenomena in the universe. Think of instruments in a concert. You have a guitar, well, not a guitar, but a bunch of other instruments, and they're all in tune, right, with their respective tones and keys. And think of the composer maybe as God, and God is conducting this orchestra of phenomena in the universe so that it all works together so that the conditions for life present themselves. And God, interestingly though, with that analogy, he's actually the composer of the piece that the orchestra is playing. He's the designer. He wrote it out first, and then he caused it to unfold as a conductor would conduct an orchestra. And so what we see is very a lot of precision, if you will, in the tuning. The tuning is perfect. Like there, it's very rare that you can get perfect tuning. Even with the best tuners out there, you really have to sit there and try to get to the right key of D, you know, when you're tuning your instrument. But God tuned our universe so amazingly, so precise. So the idea here is known as the fine tuning of the universe, and that is the idea that the universe has a large number of parameters with values and observed features that are finely tuned to accommodate life. And we could see this in the cosmological constants. So we know, like, for instance, here on Earth, gravity has this value 9.81 meters per second squared, and that's the acceleration towards the planet. So similarly, in the universe, there are a bunch of cosmological constants like that, certain magnitudes or values of numbers that allow life to obtain. Now, the actual values assumed by the constants are such that small deviations from those values would render the universe life-prohibiting. So say it was 9.82 meters per second squared. Well, that would render the universe life-prohibiting, is what is being said here, in terms of cosmological constants. Now, not that one there that I just told you, because that has to do with here, but the actual values of the constants could have been otherwise. That is, these are contingent features of this universe, and they are not necessary to this universe. They could have been different, say 1% higher or say 5,000% lower. They could have been anything, but they are what they are. And interestingly, that causes life to unfold here in our universe and on our Earth. Now, you have a few options when you explain stuff like this. You have matter and a natural causes to explain everything, and you have mind. So with the matter explanations, you have physical necessity and chance. These are all you got if you're someone who doesn't believe in God. Well, we have design too. So, or this is actually the best explanation. Now, some actually say that intelligent design is actually what supplements natural causes. So this is where the problem is that the naturalists, when they hear intelligent design, say, oh, that just means God supernaturally intervened and created something, poof, and it exists, and that's all you Christians think, and then there's no reason to do any science. Well, that's not what intelligent design is saying. It's actually saying, if you have a bunch of natural causes that produce something, do those natural causes rely on intelligent design in any way? Is intelligent design needed to supplement that natural process? Or could the natural cause and process have produced that effect in question alone? Or is intelligent design necessary in that process unfolding? Now, that's a view you can hold with intelligent design. Some people just say God, poof, created stuff, and boom, there it was. Now, that's fine, too, if you can argue that. But my point here is not to argue that. It's just to say that minimally, intelligent design is not what a lot of people think it is. Now, physical necessity is this idea that the cosmological constants of the universe had to be what they are, but that doesn't make sense because they could have been anything, 9.82 meters per second squared, anything. And so what about chance? Chance is another hypothesis that could best explain all the cosmological constants. Well, it turns out that that's a bad one, and I'll show you why in a second, but this is ruled out by definition. It's not necessary, it's contingent. So by definition, that cancels itself out. Now let's look at design first. So in terms of cosmological constants, you have the gravitational constant, you have isotropy, you have velocity of light, you have electromagnetic force, you have the strong nuclear force and weak nuclear force, you have the expansion rate of the universe, and I'm just describing a little bit there, and then you have, say, the mass density of the universe. Now, there's just 7 cosmological constants. They have a specific value, some number, right? It could have been anything different than that number. Well, astrophysicist Hugh Ross, he's documented 140 cosmological constants, where if you vary them ever so slightly, life on Earth would be impossible. Life in the universe would be impossible based on these 140. Now, that's the idea here. And there's a long and growing list that other people have seemed to build, maybe over 300 cosmological constants, that if you vary them ever so slightly, life on Earth would be impossible. In other words, the conductor of the orchestra would hear that that instrument is slightly out of tune, and he would notice and say, hey, you're out of tune, fix it. And it, you know, causes the symphony to stop, if you will. Now, these contingent cosmological constants could be anything within a wide range of values, but, and so that rules out this physical necessity idea. Okay, so we'll skip ahead, and this idea that we're getting at is the anthropic principle, is that it seems that not only life in a primitive form was thought about when God created everything, but life in an advanced form was thought about. And so the conditions were so perfect that intelligent, rational creatures would be able to thrive and advance in, on this planet. And it seems that the intelligent mind intelligent life who could observe the universe was in mind at the initial creation event and in the expansion of the universe. So it seems that intelligent life, us, was in mind when God initially created the universe to unfold with these specific cosmological constants, rendering life possible. Now, there are other observed features of the universe and our planet. Ross individually describes the effects of varying any single observed feature of the universe, different than the cosmological constant, just the relationship, say, of the Earth to the Sun, for instance. And if you vary that distance from the Earth to the Sun, then that would also render life impossible on the planet. And so he describes 402 observed features of the universe and our planet, such as the distance from a parent star, the parent star magnetic field, the date of the star formation, shutdown of the galaxy, and on and on. He describes 402 of them, and if any one of these 402 were different, we wouldn't have a planet capable of sustaining life. And these are just physical relationships or just other phenomena of the universe and life here on Earth. So what best explains this fine-tuning out of these three options, design, physical necessity, and chance? Well, this is ruled out by definition, and this is what we'll look at now. But right now, it looks like design is a really good explanation based on these remarkable relationships and constants. Now, what are the chances of getting a planet like ours? Did she talk about this by any chance?
Yeah.
Okay. All of our space exploration has shown that our neighbors in space are not remotely capable of sustaining life of any kind, of any complexity. Astrophysicist Hugh Ross has spent decades documenting all of the variables of the universe and the conditions required for life to obtain. And in his calculations, he references over 650 scholarly academic journal articles and books. So he's done a lot of research and he's done a lot of referencing. Now, how probable is a planet capable of sustaining bacteria? So bacteria is necessary for life. And so how probable is a planet capable of sustaining bacteria? Well, Ross documented that 500 parameters of the universe and Earth relate to this idea of how to sustain bacteria. Well, the probability is one chance in 10 raised to the 311th power that a single planet anywhere in the universe would be able to sustain bacteria for just a few months. How probable is a planet capable of sustaining a cell? Well, Ross documented 676 parameters that relate to sustaining a cell, and the probability is one chance in 10 to the 556th power that a cell could be sustained, and that's for 3 billion years. Now, here's the big one. Ross documented, and this is to find out how probable is a planet capable of sustaining advanced life. There are 816 parameters relating to that, and the probability is one chance in 10 to 1,032 power, to the power of 1,032. So that's 10, with 1,032 zeros behind it. That's very low, okay? That's highly improbable that you can get a planet capable of sustaining advanced life based on these 816 parameters. So he spent decades researching this. and we now can see the fruit of his labor. And how amazing that is. That is just fascinating. So what does this make of the chance hypothesis? What can we make of this in light of that? Well, it's astronomically improbable that you can get a planet that has all the features that ours does. So this doesn't look very attractive, does it? It seems that it's definitely not likely that this stuff would have just unfolded randomly. Now, there are other things that we can make and say about the universe in terms of galaxy clusters like ours. What are the chances of getting a galaxy cluster like ours? What are the chances of getting a galaxy like ours? And all of them are very low. One chance in 10 to the 130 power, one chance in 10 to the 108 power. I mean, all of these are highly, highly, highly improbable that you get a galaxy like ours, a star like ours, a planetary system like ours, a planet like ours, and an ecosystem like ours. So you can see that there's a lot of improbabilities here. And so what we're saying here is that this could be also ruled out. So it can't be by that by definition. This looks terrible, and this looks really good. So what is reasonable to conclude here? Is it reasonable to say that chance is the best explanation using abductive reasoning to say that we can best explain the phenomena of the universe by natural causes, by chance alone? That's irrational. It's unreasonable. This is out of the question. And this is extremely reasonable, very reasonable, because everything we know about the universe matches things that we create as humans. We design things all the time. We build things all the time. So that looks very attractive. And one could say then that that it seems like design was involved. And inferring design is very rational. Now, many famous astronomers, non-Christians, and astrophysicists agree that there is fine-tuning. Fred Hoyle, very famous. Super intellect has monkeyed with the physics as well as with chemistry and biology. This one, the impression of design is overwhelming. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned the universe, fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. Paul Davies, very famous cosmologist. And so thus, design is easily inferred. Any questions on that? I have you for 8 more minutes, and we're going to talk about the cell next in biochemistry. But any questions on that? Yes, sir.
One of the scientific adventures of our time right now is to find that we're on Mars right now looking for evidence of life. They're speculating there might be life on some of the other planets, moons, and whatnot.
Yeah.
Would that change the equations that you just said?
It's an interesting question because Ross makes a distinction between advanced life and primitive life. And what I've showed you is life of any kind. Life of any kind. But to get advanced life, you have to have, that's that big number I showed you. One chance in 10 to the 132nd power, or 1032. So that's to get advanced life. See that? Now, primitive life was that bacteria stuff. So yeah, say you could get something
which was still
extremely small.
But
interestingly, that happens to be very close to Earth, Mars, and interestingly, Earth has all these conditions for advanced life. Yeah, but if you go way out there, you're getting further away from our planetary system. You're getting further away from other planets like Jupiter that do certain things to affect us. So you may get a planet next to ours that has all these advanced conditions, that has conditions for primitive life, because we're kind of in that zone of the life-bearing part of the universe. So it kind of makes sense. But out there, then you're out of luck. I won't go there. Okay, so interestingly, the DNA is made of stainless steel. I don't know if you knew that, but that's just a cool picture I found on the internet. Isn't that cool? So interesting features of DNA in 8 minutes, right? So DNA as an information storage medium. Now, this is going to throw your socks off. In 2008, Japanese researchers have been able to encode into DNA text, like a sentence. They were able to write it in, if you will, kind of like you write to a CD. They were able to write it in to a biomolecule DNA, this English word or a bunch of sentences. Now, 2012, Harvard and John Hopkins University researchers have been able to write into DNA an entire book, okay? That is nuts. And this just happened. Now, what is this all about? 1 gram of DNA, in terms of this information storage capacity, think of your hard drive of your computer. 1 gram of DNA can hold up to 455 exabytes. 1 exabyte equals 10 to the 18th power bytes, which is like a gigabyte times a million or a billion. It's a big hard drive, if you will. In comparison, a CD-ROM holds about 700 million bytes. Okay, that's 10 to the 8th power, sorry. Now, 1 gram of DNA holds the equivalent amount of data as 600 billion CD-ROMs. That's 1 gram of DNA. That's how much information you could put into 1 gram of DNA. That's tremendous. Assuming a typical book requires 1 megabyte of data storage capacity, then 1 gram of DNA could harbor 455 trillion books. That is phenomenal, 1 gram of DNA. In other words, it is hard for skeptics to argue that biochemical information is only a metaphor. When biotechnologists are using DNA to store an entire book's worth of information, the more that DNA becomes the focal point of new biotechnology application, the more the claim that life comes from the outworking of undirected evolutionary processes becomes the same old tired story. So that's a quote from Dr. Fuzz Rana. He's also at Reasons to Believe, and he can help us understand the cell a little bit more. Biochemical information systems are one of the features of the cell. Structure of biochemical information is what we also see in the cell. Biochemical codes, genetic code fine-tuning, we see all of this. And what does that remind us of when you think about these features? Storage capacity, DNA having a code, and the cell using DNA to direct activity. Using DNA information to direct activity. What does that remind you of? A computer. It reminds us of a computer. Stores code. It stores information. It has codes. It does stuff like opens, like if I hit the exit button in there, the CD drive will open. You know, that's what's happening. The information directs mechanical processes and biochemical machines in the cell. That's what the information is doing. And Bill Gates, he says, DNA is like a computer, but much more complex than any computer that we have been able to design. So the idea here is that information is the key to understanding DNA. Information in the DNA is what is directing those proteins to be formed in the right way. I can tell you about all that, but we don't have time. But that's what's happening here, is that the RNA goes and transcribes the DNA, then it goes over there and sequences the amino acids, and the certain sequence of the amino acids actually form the protein. And if any of those amino acids were in the wrong position, say like if I'm making a sentence and I put the word in the wrong order, something wouldn't make sense. Well, the same thing is true of amino acids. The sequence determines the protein, what protein is actually formed. And the formation, the protein, the shape of the protein actually determines its function in the cell. So it turns out that information is the basis for all the happenings in the cell, for protein formation and everything else. And this is the revolution of microbiology. And this is very intriguing for us today. Because the DNA enigma is, where did the information come from? Not what is the cell doing, we're figuring that out just fine, and what it does and how it does it. But where did that information originate? Where do you get the information? What best explains, when you're using abductive reasoning, what best explains the origin of information? And what are the three options available to us? Physical necessity, chance, and design. Well, it turns out that these options suck and this one's good. And so I was going to end it at that, but we have one more minute. So then we look at information, we say, well, what kind of information is it? Is it just like Morse code, like repeating stuff like me, 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 something like that? Or is it more complicated information? Is it like a book, for instance, a bunch of information that gives something knowledge? Well, what we find is that the information is specified complexity in the cell. So the information is not in the cell is not just complex, it's not just improbable, but it's specified, it's independently patterned to perform a function, that, like I talked about, the protein function. So we refer to the information in the cell as specified complexity. Okay, so, and that's what I was talking to you about. And a little bit more on that, got 1 minute left, is that in the cell, information is both specified and complex. And this is crucial and necessary to explain the origin of life. So what is information? It has these features to it. There's a bunch of people out there called information theorists. They start to philosophize about what information itself is. And so these are some of the ways to describe information. So again, where does it come from? What are the two choices? Mind, where you get design, or matter, naturally caused by physical necessity, chance, or both, and what base explains the features of the cell design. And then we could continue this discussion, but in summary, that's the idea. So with astrophysics and with biochemistry, we can logically, rationally, reasonably infer design had something to do with that. And what that does is it supports, and we can rule these out too with other pieces of evidence. And what that whole idea of design supports this, that third premise in the argument I presented. And once you put all these three, four premises together, you get to build this case that science independently supports the Christian worldview. And included in that is the doctrine God created the universe and the earth, and obviously that God exists. So, are there any questions with that? Because that's about all I have. Well, actually, I have a lot more. I'm not showing you, but I spent like 6 or 8 months building this for you. But you're just getting that much. But yes, sir. Yeah, so, what I was going to do, I'm so sorry. In the first session, I asked this to happen. It happened by chance, actually. No, I'm kidding. I designed the... if you don't mind, could you just write your email on this if you want to stay to get the presentation? I'll send you this, and I'll send you the 300-page one that I'm using for my scientific apologetics class. And you could look at both, free of charge. Any questions on anything? Yes, sir.
DNA, when
what causes
that?
Yeah. Wow.
30 seconds.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so the idea is that you have random variations in the code, and the nucleotides as they form on the DNA phosphate sugar backbone of the DNA double helix. And in those nucleotides, in that sequence, they could be sequenced in such a way that something gets out of order, like say the word it in a sentence is over there and it should be over there. And so when that happens is you get all these random variations, and that affects certain cells, and these random variations of the DNA sequence causes imperfections like that.
At that point then, once the embryo is formed, it's too late to change anything.
Well, that's where we're getting in with our current science into going in there and fixing the sequence of the nucleotides so that you can resolve these implications so cancer doesn't happen, so Down syndrome and other things don't happen from that embryonic stage. And so then you're getting into stem cell research and things like that. Now that's starting to get into bioethics, which is a whole other field that Christians really should consider and articulate. And a lot of Christian philosophers like Scott Ray, for instance, are good experts in bioethical issues like that. I'm not an expert on DNA, but from what I know, I'm just fascinated by it. And but that's how I would explain that off the cuff. But there's a medical doctor here that could probably better explain that. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
So what's your take on stem cell research?
Oh,
or
right.
IVF?
Yeah, that's the whole. I'd rather not go there, but that's really good. That's real fun. But yeah, we could talk afterwards about that. Yes, ma'am. Great question. Great question. Thank you for asking. So intelligent design, you can get anything from intelligent design. You don't necessarily get the God of the Bible. In fact, you can infer, if you have let me put it this way. When you look at scientific observations, you make an inference to the best explanation, and you have two options. Now, out of this option, you can draw implications. What could be implied, but has nothing to do with the initial inference to these best explanations, but what could be implied is aliens came to the Earth and created or seeded our Earth with life. Say the first cell, and you know, set up the process of evolution. So that could be implied from intelligent design, because the alien was intelligent and had the ability and power to design and cause this process to unfold on our planet. You can get that. Now that has to do with the cell and the origin information, but you can't get that with the origin of the universe. You can't have an alien going and creating the universe, because that doesn't make sense. So now the alien implication is very valid with intelligent design. And so is pantheism. You could say that there's a bunch of gods out there, and they all collaborated. Actually, pantheism's gods are, or nature is God, right? And panentheism is saying that gods are within nature, I believe, something like that. So pantheism, panentheism, and even polytheism, that there's just a bunch of multiple gods out there, like the Greek gods, like Zeus and Athena and stuff like that. They all got together and created our universe. That could be implied from intelligent design, because those gods must exist, and they're intelligent, and they designed it. You can get that from intelligent design. But interestingly, you can also get the God of Christianity. You can get Yahweh. So that is also implied by intelligent design. And so what we do is we put it in this big argument, like I show you, four premises, and you make this general case for Christianity from that the God of Christianity exists using intelligent design. Because it's really hard to make the case for polytheism from intelligent design, you know. Other questions? Okay. For those of you that signed and want the stuff, you're free to go or come chat. So we'll just go ahead and dismiss you at this point. Thanks.
Thank you very much.